Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Welcome to the Reasonable Voices News Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. And our Reasonable Voice today is Home is a Hotel co-director and producer, Kayin Tom. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
Lovely.
Kayin is an independent media producer based in San Francisco and Kuala Lumpur. Her recent projects have won awards at film festivals around the country, including Best Short, Adrift in Sunset, and Best Narrative Feature, Collisions. She has also produced educational media and standards-based curricula-aligned content for PBS Learning Media. Kayin has more than 20 years of experience in youth development programs and organizational management. She's currently calibrating her dreams for a better world into a series of challenging projects. So welcome, Kayin Tom. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for that intro, Mamona.
My pleasure.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
I apologize.
No, you don't have to.
Yeah, I'm nervous.
Well, that's all right. We love each other's names, and it is new for us to try and pronounce them, but we're doing very well, I think, both of us. Okay. Let's start with some things that you have been up to prior to co-directing Home is a Hotel. For instance, these credits that I was listing, your Best Short. Tell us about Adrift in Sunset. Love the title.
Yeah, this is actually a sort of a comedic drama short. It's basically a young woman who is going on a date, but has to bring her mom along because she's caretaking her mother that day, and the mom has dementia. So it kind of sets up the date.
Yes, wow. That's it. You are a lady of a few words. Anything else you want to share about that?
Oh, just that it was a really lovely project with a lot of collaborators here in the Bay Area. It really sort of showcases a particular neighborhood in San Francisco called the Sunset, and so that's why it's Adrift in Sunset.
How is it living in San Francisco?
It's great. I mean, it's a really beautiful city. It's very diverse. So I come from Malaysia, which is also a very diverse country, and so when I came to the States, I actually first came for college, and I happened to have gone to the Midwest, and so it was a really difficult transition. And so once I graduated, I really wanted to find a more diverse place, and San Francisco was it. And yeah, love it.
Fantastic. My wife is from California.
Yes.
So your best narrative feature, Collisions.
Yeah, that one ISSA produced, so a little less involved in that project, but it was also a really great independent project. So most of my work is with independent filmmakers. So this particular project was about a mixed status family. So the kids were born in the States, and so they have citizenship, but the mother is from Mexico. And so the story is one day the kids are supposed to be picked up from school and mom doesn't show up. And it turns out that she had been detained as part of a raid. And so, you know, an 11-year-old and a 7-8-year-old, they try to go around the country really searching for the mother, because with detentions at that time, like, it's really hard to figure out where they had been detained. And so it's a whole, like, sort of cross-country road trip film, but about immigration.
Mm. You know, and this is a real fact of life for many people. Yeah. Yes?
Yes?
Tell us a bit more about that. I know, you know, in America we tend to think we're the best at everything and good to everybody and all that, but this entire thing with the wall and... I mean, I'm not claiming to have a solution. There is no easy solution when hundreds of thousands of people are coming to your border. What do you do? And while I'm certainly not a fan of Texas Governor Abbott, I do agree with him. It cannot be just the responsibility of the southern states. America has to be, whatever that policy is, it has to be humane, and it has to be the country making the whatever sacrifices and actions are necessary to be humane.
Yeah.
So anyway, but tell us more about it from your point of view, not just as a filmmaker, but after all, you weren't born here and you came here and you very possibly see this from a different angle than most of us. So please tell us.
Yeah, I appreciate that question a lot. And, you know, I absolutely agree. It's about being humane, first of all, right?
Yes.
So, I think one of the things we forget in this country often is that people try to come here not so much because, you know, it's like they're trying to get gold or something, right? Like California is
yes.
famous for the gold industry way back in the 1800s. So it's not about that kind of, like, you know, trying to find riches, but it's really folks just wanting a better life for their kids.
Mm.
And one of the things that it's important to remember is that some of the conditions in other countries are the result of how U.S. foreign policy systems work, or trade policies and all of these things that makes economies in other countries less viable, and therefore less opportunity. And so folks really feel like this is their only option, is to, you know, walk thousands of miles or, like, stow away on trains just to get to this country. And there's a lot that we offer, right? The U.S. is, you know, in a lot of ways, a land of opportunity.
Mm.
But they're really just trying to make a slightly better life for their kids. And, you know, I hope that we can sort of have some level of empathy for folks in terms of the hard life that they come from and that they're hoping to... you know, climb out of by working hard.
Mm.
So it's not like these are folks who are, you know, just trying to get a handout. This is not a simple, easy cross. It's not a simple, easy transition. It's like, you know, there's a lot of hardships that come along with trying to come to this country.
Gotcha. Well put. How did you get involved with PBS Learning Media?
Yeah, that was actually quite a while ago. So I used to work for an organization called CAM, Center for Asian American Media, and it's part of the public broadcast system.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things we try to do is to support any sort of film that goes into the public broadcasting system. And it's important that schools or students get exposed to a lot of these documentaries, as well as the subject matter that they cover, right?
Mm-hmm.
This was a really nice project where we were really trying to increase the diversity of what folks think of when they think of math. So this was when the Common Core standards were being rolled out across the country. And so it was students and teachers didn't quite have resources to teach these new Common Core standards. And so this was a project specifically to bring media into the classrooms, have ready-made resources that teachers can use to teach these new standards using media that was diverse, right? That showed communities that were different or that had used different languages. And so it was fun. It was a really cool project.
So it was education on many levels.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
And is that all part of your 20 years of experience with youth development programs and organizational management, or is that, or are they sort of a slightly different road?
Yeah, no, definitely. When I first started my career in this country after graduating, I really, you know, I wanted to work for, serve the community in different ways. And the way that I to do that was through youth development work in nonprofit sector. And then I realized over time that, you know what, I have a creative streak and I can't deny that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really trying to make a living, but also do something creative. And so, you know, I sort of inched towards there by working at a media arts organization. So that was my way of having some level of creativity, but also like, a, you know, a stable job and that kind of thing. And so, yeah, it's one of those things, you know, I grew up with this very strong work ethic of like really having a more like, not to say traditional career, but like something that you can explain to your parents, right?
Yeah, exactly. I knew you were going to say that.
So yeah, I was really shy from like actually pursuing anything artistic because I wasn't sure, one, if I could make it, and two, if I could explain that to my
parents. Yes.
So yeah, it took me a long time to come to this road where I felt like, oh, okay, I can make films and it's something to pursue. So yeah.
Well, good for you. I feel your pain. my parents didn't stop telling me to get a real job until they saw me on national television. And
oh, wow.
And that was not, well, I guess I was in my 30s when that happened, maybe even as old as 40. But anyway, it took a while. But they, after that, so have your parents seen your film work?
A little bit, yes.
Okay.
So the short, they've seen. The feature documentary Home is a Hotel they have not seen. And actually, my mother unfortunately passed away a few years ago. That's actually in some ways, you know, when I look back, it motivates me to pursue this a little bit more. Because
yes.
I realized that, you know, I would have loved a little bit more time to have come up with work that I could show her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she knows, as we Italians say. They know, they see everything. Nothing is truly ever gone. Okay, so youth development programs, organizational management, you've been quite busy. And creative and artistic, even if it didn't seem like it, as you were doing it. Certainly, you brought that part of your personality and your training and your passion to all of that, and just listening to you talk about it. And now you're doing a series of challenging projects. Anything you can tell us about, or is it all secret?
It's not quite secret. There's a project that I'm developing, and this is really close to my heart. So I've spent a lot of years being a producer, right? And so in some ways, the role of a producer often is to support the vision of a director.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I enjoy that role. I love the production side of things as well. But at this stage in my life, I really felt like there was something else I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started writing. So I'm doing a project, a narrative series, actually. And it's set in Southeast Asia, and the idea of what the world kind of looked like in that region, pre-colonial contact. And I really want to be able to show like a very diverse world, mm-hmm. and a diverse world that was also very vibrant, meaning that, you know, the whole region was incredibly source of art, trade, you know, even like systems of governance. They were all very well developed before colonial contact. I think often Southeast Asia gets seen as, you know, the place that didn't exist until, you know, folks from the West came. So it's the idea is to show a little bit more of that world, but it, within an adventure series kind of setting.
Excellent. Well, this has been grand. I love hearing about you. And before the folks from the West came in, I will forever treasure that phrase. Well put. We're going to take a short break. This is fabulous. And when we come back, we're going to hear from Kalyan Tom about Home is a Hotel, a movie feature that she has co-directed. Please stay with us. This is an excellent guest. Very happy to have her on the show. So stay with us. We'll be right back. To better understand the and grasp the gravity of SROs, as illustrated in the independent film directed by our guest today, here is a scene, a trailer, from his independent film, Home is a Hotel.
A SRO is a room. And you gotta build your whole life in a room.
No kitchen, bathroom in the hallway. It's called a single room occupancy, SRO hotel.
Could you fit your whole life in a room?
I said, I need a place to be, to get clean, you know, to stay clean. I can't do it homeless.
No one wants to live this way where your table doubles as your bed. But I'll take my blessings wherever I can get them because I definitely didn't have anywhere else to go.
An intimate portrait of five households living in 80 square foot single room occupancies.
My parents and I were lucky to even get this room. It's $900, but it's a place we could call home.
Winner of the Jury Award for Bay Area Documentary and the Audience Award at the San Francisco International Film Festival, Home is a Hotel takes a deep dive into surviving on the margins in one of the country's most expensive cities. Visit www.homeisahotel.com for screening info.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices News Talk radio program. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, and our guest today, our Reasonable Voice today, is Home is a Hotel co-director and producer, Kalyan Tom. And Kalyan has been telling us about her journey. I like to do that with guests, as you know. I want to know what road they have traveled, what path have they gone before they get to perhaps the main event of why I ask them to be on the show. And so we're going to go to that now, a feature film recently released and being seen. We'll let her tell us all about that so we make certain we get the dates correct. So Home is a Hotel. It opens with the statement, in the early 1980s, San Francisco began a policy of using residential hotels as a stopgap solution to address the city's growing decline in affordable housing. And that's the key, that word, affordable housing. When I first saw the film, or before I saw it, you know, and I've been a landlord and all that sort of thing, and I saw residential hotels, I thought, well, you know, in my business as a director and actor, I travel a lot. I spend a lot of time in hotels, and I was thinking that's what they were talking about. But it turns out that that's not the kind of hotel they are talking about. So, Kalyan, tell us about this. Yes.
Yeah, it's almost like a misnomer to call it a hotel.
Yes.
Yeah, these are residential hotels, they're called, but in terms of how they're set up, it's really just one small room and maybe a sink in the room, and that's all you get, which is fine if you were, you know, sort of someone that it was originally designed for, which is that you're a short-term laborer that has come into San Francisco for work, and, you know, you stay for a week or two, a month maybe, and then you leave. And so that's what it was designed for, SROs, single-room occupancy hotels. But they've become, because of the inaffordability of housing in the San Francisco Bay Area, is that it's become the housing of mass choice, I guess, in a way, of the only affordable housing available for folks who are low income. And so it's supposed to be temporary, but for some folks, you know, there's even folks who've stayed in there for generations.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's a really difficult situation in the Bay Area.
So did the discovery of this 1980s California history influence your coming on board to co-direct Home is a Hotel?
Actually, I sort of came on board. I knew a little bit about SROs because I had worked with LGBTQ youth in San Francisco. And one of the main issues for queer youth is that they were often thrown out of their own homes, right? So they tended to come to the Bay Area for shelter and for safety, and SROs actually was a good option for us to put up folks for a night or two in those situations so that we can stabilize and get them to a safe environment from there. And so when I heard about this project, my impression of SROs is that, you know, it's actually an important part of a safety net in the city. But once I got into this project, I realized, wait a minute, things have changed. You know, the affordability has completely changed to a point where, yeah, folks really have no other option but to live in SROs, and especially families. So that wasn't the case when I first started working with LGBTQ youth and putting them in emergency housing situations in SROs. And so, yeah, it really changed my perspective in terms of what that was.
And to be clear, it's a single-room occupancy hotel, which was, I guess, initially, as you experienced it, it was initially supposed to be a temporary solution to a long-term problem. But it has become, as you've said, not only for, so we don't, even though they say single in the single room occupancy, it's not just for singles, it's families. And they're all in this one room with a sink. Where's the kitchen? Where's the bathroom? Where do they have those facilities?
Yeah, so different buildings are set up slightly differently. And so often you'll have a shared bathroom in the hallway. And then in terms of kitchen, each building may or may not have a kitchen, and if they do have a kitchen, it's usually on like every other floor, not even on each floor. And so one of the young families that we followed into the Chinatown, and so the shared kitchen, for example, is one of those things. She would have to wait like 2 hours in line just to make dinner.
Oh, goodness.
And so it's a little bit impossible.
And people live like this in some cases for years.
Yes, absolutely. Again, you know, it's an affordability issue. And so we're really trying with this film to let folks see what it's like to be in that situation. And hopefully, you know, we understand that this is an issue that we can all do a little something about, you know, whether it's supporting folks with a little bit more. You know, there's this whole movement for universal basic income, for example. And that could have helped a lot of our folks in the film, for example, because they were working. They have a source of income, but they just could not make enough to live in a different setting. And so having a little bit of income support, for example, would have made such a huge difference. And then the other is just, you know, these housing assistance programs. Like, the waiting lists often are years and years. And so even fixing those kinds of systems or providing more vouchers for folks to find subsidized housing, like, all of these things could help. And I think as residents, you know, it's important for us to, you know, help make the city livable for everyone, right? Not just folks who have incredible means.
You know, and I think, and I don't say this to be trite by any means, but SROs are equal opportunity housing. As your film shows, home is a hotel. There are black people, Asian people, white people, children, senior citizens, working people, artistic people, divorced people, abused women, immigrants, artists, musicians. There's also a blind woman in the film, and it's like, yeah, when you look at that, because people get such stereotypical images of what's going on, you know, that they're not a part of. But this is really, this is happening to a lot of different people who are at a lot of different cultures and backgrounds. And they end up here primarily, it seems, if I'm getting the message from Home is a Hotel, primarily because as states and counties and cities build housing, there are a lot of houses, you know, they're building housing, but they're not building housing that lower income people can afford to rent. Is that an issue? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, even, I mean, you know, I don't want to go into like specifics of policy per se, but there is an issue of like what's even considered affordable housing. Right. Well, when there are these very technical terms around, you know, like percentage of income and like median income in the area and all of that stuff. But really, the reality is that you could work, you know, more than 40 hours a week and still not make enough to rent a proper place. Mm. And that's really the issue. Right. So I think that's why you have so many different people from different backgrounds facing this issue, because it's not about individual choices that someone has made or bad choices someone has made along their life. It's about the fact that the numbers don't work, you know? Like, you only have so many hours in a day and you can only work so much. And if your wages are that low, it doesn't support your ability to actually find a livable place.
How do we break this cycle? Something at the political level has to happen. And how feasible is that? How can people be, that great series, you know, the film, When They See Us, how feasible is it that enough politicians see them as people who they need to be concerned about? How do we do that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm a filmmaker, right?
Yes.
So that was my way, is to try and show what was happening and to show it in a way in which hopefully folks can engage with the topic. And that's all I think that, you know, each one of us, we have a different role in life. We have different access to things. We have different communities. We might know different things. And I think what I'm asking in this particular case with this film is just to reflect and for us to engage with how our communities are right now, right? So if you think about this issue in your own neighborhood, like what could you as you know, someone with a particular set of education, a particular set of connections, a particular set of ideals, what could you do in this situation? That's what I'm asking.
Because yes.
I think, you know, we're all part of a community, and we have each a role to play in what this community looks like. And if we feel like, you know, housing is important, if we feel like it's important for folks to have a safe environment to grow up, then let's do something.
Yes. And you and I so appreciate your answer. I'm not at all surprised that you went there with it. The point is, we all have something to give, something to share. We all have a talent in something. We all can be a friend. We all can deliver food. And everybody can do something. You don't have to have $1 million or $1 billion or win the lottery. You can do something. And in your case, you and Kevin Duncan Wong have made this film. Home is a Hotel, but everybody has something they can share. And I think as we're back getting shots for prevent catching COVID, it's important to mention that in the living conditions in an SRO, COVID must have been a serious threat, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, you know, in the San Francisco context, the Latino community, Latinx community, really suffered the most. They were often in neighborhoods that were dense, as well as the particular type of housing. And so there was no social distancing available. And particularly in an SRO setting, you know, you can't really physically distance. And so one of our protagonists, Esther, who's the songwriter, she unfortunately succumbed to COVID. This was early days. It's part of what it means to live in these kinds of environments.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we have to be aware that when we talk about any sort of, like, even COVID, which, as you know, equalized a lot of things.
Yes.
In the world, but you could also see that it did affect certain communities more because of these living conditions.
You know, the more I'm listening to you, I really think this is a film everyone needs to see. Home is a Hotel, because film has that power, first of all. You know, when you see this, and I should explain, or I should ask you to explain, this the style of this, we call it a documentary because that's what you and Kevin call it, but in my opinion, it's more of a slice of life, and the audience needs to be prepared for that so that they don't shy away from it. For instance, there are no people sitting in a nice library, comfortable chair, explaining things.
Right.
You see, day by day, moment by moment, family by family. You and Kevin refer to Home is a Hotel as a documentary, and of course it is, but it's also a slice of life film. We step into the lives of these people thanks to your film, Home is a Hotel. And everyone may be surprised that there's no narration per se. There's no person sitting in, you know, well-off person, historian or whatever, government official, you know, sitting in the library explaining what we're about to see or what we just saw. We are seeing the lives of these people who are being affected by where they live and where they must live because they, in most cases, have no choice. Tell us why you made that choice to be more of a slice of life rather than a sort of narrated documentary.
Yeah, absolutely. I think two reasons. One is housing and housing policy has become a really contentious issue. I think because, you know, in some ways it's so visible, especially in California, and everyone has an opinion about it, which is great. Like, we want people to engage. But I think one of the things that's missing is the voices of folks who are actually most affected and what it takes to actually get housing. And we wanted to get away from the quote-unquote expert voice, or what we might expect to be expert voices, and really just invite folks to live into the experience a little bit by following the folks and getting a real sense of what it's like. Because sometimes we get in our heads, you know, about what it means, but it's not until you really see it. And so that's what we're hoping, is just to invite folks to live with our characters for a little bit, and hopefully, you know, that gives us a change in perspective.
Exactly. And I promise you, everyone, no matter what you look like, you will see someone who looks like you in this film, Home is a Hotel. And that, to me, is one of its greatest gifts to us, because we have to look at it. We have to see that this is life for many people, and people who are similar to us and people who are not. But it is a fact. It's not something to be ignored. Also, one of the points made in this wonderful film, Home is a Hotel, is Section 8. You know, most of us know about Section 8s from MASH, and, you know, Section 8s are not funny, and they have rippling effects. So tell us a bit about that, how the Section 8 figures into your film and in general in life for people who are living with minimal income.
Yeah, Section 8 is crucial. It's the one subsidized housing program that really has helped folks that we followed in this film, and especially for the families. And so there was a particular new but very short-lived program that was launched in San Francisco for specifically families living in SROs. And so there was a lottery of vouchers given to families. And just so happened that the families in our film got those vouchers. And you can see how their lives completely changed from that. And so that's actually one of the things that I hope people get from it too, is that, you know, these kinds of programs are absolutely, absolutely crucial and life-changing. And so, yeah, even as bureaucratic as some of these systems can be, they're crucial. And so let's support that and keep them going.
So I guess it's an obvious thing to say, you hope that Home is a Hotel will inspire change in the system, or at least awareness in the larger community, so that they can make the change. Is that a good assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think as filmmakers, our first role is to, in some ways, show a particular slice of life, right, as you say, in this film. But of course, we always have these bigger hopes for what that means. And in this particular case, yeah, we do hope that people have greater connection and understanding of communities living in this situation, and feel like this is something that we can all do something about.
You know, a point I think before we go, we certainly should make this point. While the rents have increased dramatically, the federal minimum wage hasn't changed since 2009. Expand on that for me. How does that affect this whole issue?
Yeah. I have to say, I was shocked when I found that out in doing research for this. And, you know, granted that a lot of states do have their own minimum wage that is higher than the federal level, but still 22 or 21 states in the country uses the federal minimum wage rate. And it's crazy like that, as we all know, right, prices of things have gone up in all sectors of life.
Yes.
Cost of living is just higher. But if we do not have a certain standard for minimum wage, then again, you see this, like, it increases our desperation in life because you no longer have the ability to support yourself. And that doesn't help in any society, right? Because then you get all kinds of difficulties, like social ills, because people just aren't making the income that they need, and not for the lack of trying.
Tell me what you think about this statement. There is no state or county in the country where a renter working full-time at minimum wage could afford a one-bedroom apartment at the current prevailing rate.
That was another really shocking finding. And I think, you know, it's just, again, it's really looking at the system. We're hoping that folks have a sense that this is a systemic issue, and that affordable housing is key, and that we don't have enough of it. There's an absolute lack, and yeah, we cannot sustain ourselves as a society on this trend, I think.
Exactly. All right, we're going to have to go now, but I wonder if you could tell us how we get a hold of you. How do we see the film? When is it? You know, where can we see it, and when? Social media, website, everything now. Look, give us what we need to reach out.
So we have a website. It's www.homeisahotel.com. And we actually have a list of upcoming screenings there. We're going to be screening at the Austin Film Festival coming up, San Diego Asian Film Festival coming up, and New Filmmakers LA. So, yeah, we're in different cities for the rest of the year. And as well, we hope to, at some point, be on some kind of public broadcast so that folks, again, we don't need, you know, you don't need to have a streaming service to watch it. So that's what we're hoping, to be able to make it accessible as well for folks.
Well, I have to tell you, it's certainly been enlightening. Even though I've interviewed Kevin Duncan Wong, who is the co-director with Ka Yin Tom, it's still shocking. And just to talk about it and to get both perspectives, I feel quite fortunate. So I hope you will listen to both shows. But most of all, find a way of seeing Home is a Hotel. Let's give that that website again, nice and slowly, so people know where they can find more information. I presume all the information for the screenings is available there.
Yes, it's www.homeisahotel.com. Oh. And thank you so much, Marcello, for this conversation. I really appreciate it.
I don't know if pleasure is the right word, but it certainly was enlightening and informative, and I greatly appreciate your being on the show and sharing both your film and your expertise and your journey to this point, and the fact that you are now, this is your passion and mission in life. I think all of us should be impressed with that. Thank you so much, and we wish you all the very best, okay?
Thank you, Marcello.
All right. Bye now.
And now, enjoy Watchfire Music featuring vocal artist Jenny Burton singing Tear Down the House from Is Anybody Listening?
Tear it up.
For all now, we'll build it for the child in you. Innocent hearts now, we'll build it for all the world to see. What's in the past, those who built it did the things they had to do. But something happened along the way. Something managed to go astray. It's true. Now we gotta tear down the house. Tear it down. We better build it back up on a higher ground. Oh yeah. Tear down the house. Tear it up. And start it again. But if you're gonna tear down the house, we must respect.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. America, the field of dreams, occasionally. We are no longer what we thought we were. The good, bad, ugly truth is, it didn't begin with Donald Trump. However, like a Booth decapitation, Don the Con played cokeheads by bolstering the South Shall Rise Again, reawakening faux patriotism, whitewashing seething hate for our justice for all field of dreams. Increasingly, our age group, categorical culture, or political comfort zone is proliferating our weaknesses into a new all-inclusive enslavement, reverberating January 6, 2021. Whether right, left, or fence wobblers, we've allowed ourselves to be brought by lazy, repetitive corporate media, Wall Street warlord peddlers, and flag-waving, constitutionally illiterate conservatives into a collective, self-deceiving trifecta, which, if American democracy is to survive, we've got some serious, soul-searching scaffolds to strengthen sooner or lose any forward mobility away from the 21st century corporate boardroom occupants who've mangled our American dream potential into their bowed Bill of Rights, violently clinging to the manipulated memories of the good old days of Southern poll taxes, Northern molasses to rum to slaves, to national book burning, MAGA Republicans have spawned a new nation, offering up domestic gun violence, invigorating the worst among our hypocrisy-ridden politicians, and a heartland turning evangelicalism heartless. First, they elected Tricky Dick twice, and then an administration of war criminals, spinning our massive 9/11 tragedies into absolution of their complicity in the death and maiming of thousands of American and foreign lives, while washing their hands in J.D. Rockefeller's black gold residue. Unscrupulously marketed, post-World War II Americans were brainwashed into believing we are superior to all life on Earth, better than anyone, at anything, anywhere. We were not, and still aren't. Not even north of the Mason-Dixon line. Truly, it is okay not to be perfect, but it is perhaps the most sinful self-deception to think, and worse, proclaim ourselves morally superior to all. Current too-big-to-jail robber barons are Americans contributing for profit to our polluted water, food inequity, and nebulous air quality on an earth being devoured from the inside out. Whether negligently forgetting or simply anticipating a planetary relocation for those who pay, economic elitists are ignoring our human responsibility to be stewards, not rapists, of the earth. What exactly will MAGA Americans, shadowing Ohio's Pied Piper Jim Jordan, profit if he gains the whole world by forfeiting American souls? Yet, for some, truth struggles to reveal itself. And yes, historically, most of America's troubles have been caused by blindly following the lust for power of grumpy old Caucasian men. Nonetheless, not all old white men are anti-democracy and anti-humanity trumped. So discarding a stuttering kid who became president of the United States for a big liar's big lie is suicidal. The American experiment isn't so much failing as it is being failed. Parents with little education in education demanding teachers teach students what their parents were taught. Memorize dates, timetables, and half-truths until we too become dittos for leaders of institutionalized religion, hateful governors, and stockpiles of Wall Street's counting houses, financial institutions sliming the American dream. We have been programmed to look away from the true villains, oil company boards, and owners of private prisons, inciting homeland infighting over lies they tell us. Know this, in any attempt to disappear the power of a nation's electorate, the perpetrators' public faces disguise the devils who take from all deemed easily taken. Numbers like figures on a block, becoming figures on a ledger. The CEO to average worker pay ratio, 1965 was 20 to 1. 1989, it was 44 to 1. Today, 2023, 400 to 1. Enabling future generations to make better choices than we need replace book burning with character development through objective evaluation to prevent Supreme Coke puppeteers from keeping us in our place. Parroting mistakes were made. We spoke and understood as children in a Reagan fantasy where welfare queens were branded unworthy. Like children, we thought political profiteers Bob Menendez and Jared Kushner would not repeat Joe McCarthy and Spiro Agnew's deceits. But aging out of childhood, we must put away childish things, like a president who compromises our national security more even than Tommy Tuberville. We must master rational thought, adult civility, and the discernment to recognize the manipulation of patriotism by craven corporatism, filling our stomachs by sacrificing our international food sources, increasing denials from health insurers, and climate change blitz. Whether we believe in a little sand from the dust of Earth's surface, a touch of life-giving ocean salt water stirred by the unshakable, with something borrowed, a rib perhaps, in a garden paradise brimming with flowers, shrubs, and garnished with life and wisdom-bestowing trees, or whether we believe millions of years evolving from the sea through artistic caves to Grand Central Station. Either way, generations of powerfully ensconced money changers will continue to profit from our raging against each other, fighting their war against our freedom to think for ourselves and to dream. President Ulysses S. Grant said, "If we are to have another contest in the near future for our national existence, I predict that the dividing line will not be Mason and Dixon's, but between patriotism and intelligence on the one side, and superstition, ambition, and ignorance on the other." I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, and I know where my voice belongs. I hope the same for you. Thank you, and join us. Become one of the Reasonable Voices, heard round the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the Reasonable Voices heard round the world.